1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by Diddy TV. Visit DiddyTV.com for more exclusive on-demand content or download the official Diddy TV app from your app store today. From Diddy TV, this is Insights, where today, Amy Wright gets to chat with Bill Payne, the Waco, Texas native who, along with Lowell George, co-founded the legendary and incomparable rock band Little Feat. When it comes to piano and organ work and the mix of genres that are rock, blues, funk, and jazz, no one does it quite like Bill Payne. Outside of Little Feat, Payne has also recorded and worked with J.J. Cale, Jimmy Buffett, the Doobie Brothers, Emmylou Harris, Pink Floyd, Linda Ronstadt, Bonnie Raitt, and countless others. A shockingly impressive list of artists for sure. He's a true creative with a distinct voice and perspective, with great skills reaching into photography, writing, and other realms. We're grateful to have him on the show today, and happy to share the conversation with you right now. So let's get to it. Here's Amy Wright and Bill Payne on Insights.
How long have you lived in Montana?
I've been up here since, I built a place here in 1980, and I probably lived here for 10 or 11 years, I guess. I'm not sure, maybe 12.
But, are you a skier at all, or?
I used to cross-country ski, but I'm a little more, I play golf now. When I turned 73, actually in my late 60s, mid-60s, I started kind of doing less. So I'm 73 now. My wife is 26 years younger than I am, so she's good at all and any and all that stuff. But the last time I was out, I was cross-country skiing, if you're just on the flats, that's cool. But if you're going down hills, which we've done before, I don't want to mess with my hands. I can't.
The music is more important than the skiing at that point.
Yeah, you get a little cautious sometimes, and you can't afford to be too cautious. But you can't afford to be weird either. So I said, we'll get out if we need to. We had snow about 3 days ago. It's raining today. It's beautiful.
Yeah, well, we're the opposite of snow down here where we are right now. So it's almost 90 degrees.
So. Yeah, no, I get it. I was in Florida not too long ago, so.
Yeah, I love Montana. I mean, I haven't spent really any time there, but we have friends that that live there and work at a ski resort there. So,
oh, cool.
They're sending us photographs all the time, and we have summer jealousy when it gets really hot. We're typically in Memphis. That's where our studio is for the television network.
Good.
So, but we tape other places as well. So we happen to be down here, but typically we're in Memphis and it's hot as hell in the summer. So you sort of deal with that. Where did you actually grow up?
I grew up in, I was born in Texas, Waco, or Waco as I've called it for years. But, from 2 years of age on, I was in Ventura, California, which is on the coast. I was a surfer and skateboards and all that cool stuff. And then when I was 15, which would have been the half semester of my first year in high school, 10th grade. I think nowadays kids go into high school in 9th grade, but back then, 10th grade, I was up in Santa Maria, which is in Central California. And that's where I joined my first band when I was 15.
So when did you learn to play piano?
I learned to play piano when I was about 5, so I've been playing piano for about 68 years, which is a long time. So
was that imposed upon you by your parents, or did you say, I want to play piano when you were a kid?
Maybe there's a little girl across the street named Marilyn Newell, and she was taking piano lessons. I said, well, if Marilyn can take piano lessons, I should be able to take piano lessons too. So my sister had already tried the piano, didn't fit with her. But my brother tried, he was a little younger, but so years later he tried as well, didn't fit with him. But it fit with me great. I had a teacher named Ruth Newman, who was like a second mother to me. And she told my mom, she says, I'll make sure Bill knows how to read music. Let's not take the magic out of it for him. Let him play by ear.
Beautiful.
So I had a dual track there. I'm sitting next to my piano here.
Oh, wow, look at that.
This is an instrument, 7-foot Yamaha, that I played on the first couple of Emmylou Harris records, and later with Travis Tritt. And somehow I got a hold of that through Brian Ahern, who is married to Tammy. And he, sometimes when Brian gets in touch, he'll say, "How's our piano doing?" And I always say, "Possession's 9/10 of the law. It's my piano. It's doing fine."
So when did you actually take up the B3? Was that later?
Yeah, it was later. I was actually, when I was 10, I think 10 years old, I started taking pipe organ lessons at the Presbyterian Church, which was across the street in Ventura, where Ruth lived. And I remember it having 4 to 5 manuals. And it gave me that positioning of where, like what I play with Little Feet now, where I've got the main keyboard here, let's say, and then up here is another keyboard that I can reach over to. With the Doobie Brothers, I had another keyboard on my right side, so I could be bouncing back and forth between 3 keyboards. I learned that acumen through pipe organ. And so that's kind of the way it works with me, is if I'm playing a Mozart piece, let's say, practicing Mozart, I can be playing that, and then I'll go off onto another tangent, play something else, and come back to Mozart. And it's all about facility. How do you, the finger memory and everything it takes to play classical music, how does that intersect with what you're doing as an improvisationalist?
And I learned that. You grew up playing classical music then, and then when you formed your first band, was that a transition when you had to move from classical to more of a contemporary kind of?
No, because at age 5, I went into my teacher and I played the Davy Crockett song, right? Which she then transcribed for me, said, "This is what you played." And that's when she told my mom, "Look, I'll make sure he can read, but let's not take the magic out of it. Let him discover what's there." To me, it's the piano is a means to, it's like having, it's another extension of my voice, right? So I can play. I've written 20 songs with Robert Hunter because of that ability to take lyrics and bring them into ideas. And this thing has been there since I started playing. Not that I could do that. I didn't write a song until much later. In fact, when I auditioned for my first band, I was playing drums, sort of. And they had a piano over there against the wall. I started playing. They go, "You play the piano?" I go, "Well, I guess." And I'd been playing for over 10 years at that point. So I wasn't exceedingly focused back then as to what I wanted to do and why. But the notion of being in a band, which was a lifesaver for me as a kid, because I was sad because I moved from Ventura to San Marino. I went from that beach environment that you have as your background to the more of the Central California environment, which is your landlocked. And it took me a little bit to adjust, even though I was going down to surf during the weekends or whenever I could. But one had a chance to, not only did the camaraderie of being in a group, but there was the element, which is, you know, it's cliche at this point, but another cliche that's true, are girls. You're going to meet a lot of girls playing music. And I did, and it was fun. And I thought, this is a nice way to lead a life of what I want to do, which is play music and have people that think you're okay. So it was fun.
Do you remember the name of your first band?
Yeah, it's called the Debonairs. And the Debonairs, when I played the piano, they go, "We're dissolving this group here right now. We're going to go down to this garage where this fellow has all the gear and equipment. It's called the Debonairs. You're going to play keyboards, da da da." We're off. So years later, I was in a group called Something Wild. And there's a photo of Something Wild with Peter Asher, because he was in town playing with Peter and Gordon. And Peter and I laughed about that because years later, I mean, when he's producing Linda Ronstadt and James Taylor and on, I finally got into that clique when I started working with Linda myself, and then later with James. And then later, much later than that, Peter managed Little Feat. Peter Asher, for those that are unfamiliar with him, the lyrics to I Want to Hold Your Hand were written at his house down the basement. And Paul McCartney was dating Peter's sister, Jane. So Jane Asher. So, yeah, there's a lot of, it's like a Dickinson tale, honestly, the way all this stuff sort of works out. And people meet, they don't see each other for years, and they reconnect, and then there's a slow broil, and then things move into something else. It's been a hell of a ride. And it's still a hell of a ride with Little Feat these days, with two new members, Scott Sherrard, Tony Leone, on guitar and drums, vocals with both these guys. A lot of people that have heard us, Amy, it's either we haven't sounded this great in like 20, 25 years, or we haven't sounded this great since the late 70s, or we've never sounded any better than we sound now. The point is, we sound really good. And we're adding to our legacy by playing Waiting for Columbus, and that we go out there and we don't replicate. We replicate the order up to a degree. I think we switched that up even a few weeks ago, but the Little Feat has always been an improvisational band. So we still maintain that within the arrangements that we play. But these are some fine, fine musicians that can. Fred Tackett, who's been with us for a long time too, he says, you know, we can play anything. I go, that's exactly right. Anything we want to play. I mean, there's stuff we couldn't do, obviously, but most of what we want to play, which is, it would take 10 bands to you'd have to be in 10 bands to play the breadth of material that we play anyway. It's just been such an exciting ride, because this was born during COVID, right? We didn't really know what we'd be like when we got in a room with each other until last November. 2021, and it's one thing to play music long distance wise, it's another one to get in a room and play. Does everyone get along together, for example, right? Bands are personalities, right? It was like old home week. I mean, we got together fine on the last gig we played, which is a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago maybe. We were still messing around with the arrangement for Fat Man in the Bathtub when it came to my solo. Kenny Grady was playing Tequila, which I'd thrown in every now and then, but it was just me and the drums were playing, Tony and I. But the whole band started playing, we're at soundcheck. I said, stop, this is what we need to do tonight. Let's have the whole band play this right at the get-go when I start my solo. It just took it to this party atmosphere. I mean, those people down the beach would be dancing and having a ball. And that's exactly what happened that night. And it was good before. It was better, though. And so the synergy and energy that we have, you hear it in my voice, too. You know, we're talking about how these things come together. This is not an exercise in, like, gee, can we play Waiting for Columbus? Well, hell yeah, we can. Can we bring it to life to where people that are expectant of something, do we deliver? And yeah, we do. These people are like, oh my gosh, it does sound this good.
So it has to be gratifying, you know, to feel like, hey, I've been doing this for so many years and I feel like I'm at my best right now. I mean, that's got to be gratifying.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think the metric that you use to determine how good you are is, look, I hear stuff I played when I was in my 20s that I just go, God, how did I do that? It's good. I mean, but I knew for a very long time, at least I felt that I wasn't going to denigrate any of my work before, but I felt like I was on a trajectory somehow, some way, to deliver my best stuff later. So writing 20 songs with Robert Hunter, you know, that's pretty good. He did not suffer fools gladly. And, one of the compliments we gave, I said, you know, Robert, the music's in the lyrics. Let's be honest. I'm drawing out what's already there. He says, yes, but it takes a composer to draw them out. I mean, we never met. We never spoke with each other on the phone. Excuse me. Everything was done long distance. We emailed one another, and yeah, we came up with 20 songs. I think it says a lot about both of us. I think the partition between us maybe allowed us to write that 20 songs. We didn't have a lot of room for the extracurricular. Hey, nice to know you. And at one point I said, you know, it's kind of like an internet bride Guatemalan situation. I'm sure you're a nice man. we were going to meet at some point, but we never did. And but I've retained all the 200 plus emails that we went back and forth with.
Well, let's go back a little ways. How did you originally meet Lowell George and the very beginning of Little Feet? Tell me a little bit about what happened there and how y'all came together.
That was in 1969. I was sleeping on a beach in the people's apartments up in Isla Vista, which is in Santa Barbara. And I dropped out of junior college the second year, so half of the second year. Dropped out of junior college. And there was an album out by Frank Zappa called Uncle Meat, and M-E-A-T, and I wanted to join Frank's band. So with a phony calling card, there was two labels that Frank had, Straight and Bizarre. I called Bizarre. And they said, well, Frank's going to be in Europe for a month. There's a guy named Jeffrey Simmons. So I checked out Jeffrey Simmons from a group called Eureka. I went down to the Tropicana Hotel in motel, I guess, on Santa Monica Boulevard. We met very briefly. He goes, you know what? You play really good keyboards, but I kind of play them too, and maybe this wouldn't work, but there's a guy named Lowell George you should seek out. And so I went back up north, just Isla Vista. I called Warner's a few more times. Keep in mind that nobody knew who I was. I barely knew who I was. And I'm going, well, I play keyboards, and I convinced one of these secretaries at Warner's to hook me up with Lowell, to hook me up with whomever. I mean, it was just, so when I met Lowell, he was living on Rowena, which was not far from Silver Lake, but it wasn't Silver Lake, it was the next little city over, and a very rustic house. I walked up to the door was open, it was hot, it was summertime. There was a beautiful blonde with short hair, cross-legged, listening to some Eric Satie, and she says, oh, you must be Bill. Lowell's expecting you. He'll be back in 4 hours. I said, what does he do when he's not expecting you? So long story, a little longer. I went through his album collections. I was looking at his books and stuff. By the time he arrived, about 4 hours later, I kind of felt like I knew who he was. And we started talking. It was not unlike what I'd read about Fidel Castro and Che Guevara getting together the first time, where they spoke about everything under the sun. And so I didn't immediately join Little Feet. That took place about a month later when I did meet Frank. But by that time, I decided I really want to be in this band with Lowell. And when I met Richie, who was with the Fraternity of Man, that's how it all came together. Summer of 69, what I called the Summer of Love, Murder, and Men Walking on the Moon.
So who came up with the name? Was that Lowell or?
I think it was Lowell. He had Lyle Gleep was one of the things he wanted to call him. There was a group called Bigfoot, and we were going to change our name from Little Feet to something else. I said, you know, no offense to Bigfoot, but I don't think they're going to last very long. And they didn't. So
how long before you actually got picked up by a label?
About a year later.
That's pretty quick for a band.
Yeah, you know, we auditioned probably 12 to 14 bass players, in which Paul Brer was one of them. And we got Paul for Dixie Chicken 2 albums later.
When you guys had Willin, one of your big hits, was on the first album, but it was also on the second album, right? You re-recorded it, or did you re-release it as a single?
I don't think it was ever released as a single. We never had any singles that, say, duplicated what the Doobie Brothers were doing. They were actually a hit band. We were not. If you listen to the first, or anybody out there listens to the first Willin off of that first self-titled record, to my mind, it sounds like a caricature of a truck stop, of a truck driver, right? It doesn't mm-hmm. have any keyboards on it, which doesn't mean anything. But it was just that's a good song. The song was there, but then listen to the rendition that's on Sailing Shoes. That's where that song really came to life. It had more of a country feel to it. I came down to LA, fully aware who Conway Twitty was and George Jones and a bunch of others. And not that Lowell didn't know, but it was a way that I was able to bring some influence into the band from a country side of things. But we had a lot of different music we were playing, so that we all contributed to different styles, and that's the way bands operate, generally speaking.
Did you feel like everyone was on the same page stylistically, or were people going down different paths and maybe it all came together, but where were your heads in terms of
I think we were style? We were as scattered as what we are today in society, right? Everybody mm-hmm. had a different idea what the truth was or what anything meant, and which water. Nobody even was worried about bottled water back then except me. for touring, you know, why do you want to have bottled water for? I go, because the water is different everywhere you go, and it affects your system differently. So I've been drinking this since I was a little kid, Culligan water. Ventura. So at any rate, we did branch out into different areas of thought, obviously, but we also had this umbrella of things where, yeah, we did Ray Charles, we like James Brown, we like Beatles, Stones, or Dewey, or Leon Russell. Wow, that's cool. Dylan. We had things that we could choose from. It was a golden age of music. There weren't these real tight set lists. People were playing things on the radio that were loose, informative, and adventurous.
So in the sort of these early years, were you putting out an album and touring, or were you pretty much putting out an album and going right back at it and putting out the next album?
No, we're album tour, that kind of thing. And, It's gotten to the point now where people wonder if albums are even necessary. And I contend that they are. Not albums per se, but just songs. What are you trying to say to your audience? Are we stuck with playing Dixie Chicken? That's fine. People go, well, how do you keep Dixie Chicken so fresh? I said, well, how do we keep singing Happy Birthday so fresh? You know what I mean? It's in your heart. Hopefully when you're singing it to the person at the dinner table or wherever you are, you actually mean it. And that's kind of what it is with any and all of this. It's I figure at whatever age I'm at, I'm very fortunate to have been able to and still be able to play music. It's something I absolutely adore, and there you go.
Yeah, I would think it would be just... I would think it'd be amazing to have people constantly requesting some song that, you know, I had written whenever that was. Doesn't mean that you're not writing new music, but the fact that you have songs that are so memorable that people request them every time you play. That has to be great.
Yeah, and I don't get hung up on any of it. I mean, the songs that you play and write, they over a period of years will implant themselves into people's heads, just the way the older ones do. Now they're old as well. This is like moving through life, right? And what songs provide, and why I think music is as important now as ever, perhaps, is because of this split that we have as a bunch of humans. Music is an area where we don't have to show our card, so to speak, as we go in to listen to something. We don't have to debate politics. We don't have to debate anything. We sit there and we go, man, Spanish Moon sounds terrific. It moves my soul. Will and our time as a hero, we might be showing something on a screen in back of us, and we can't do it every night, but some of the festivals, I don't know, we'll be able to, but it just brings people to tears, and they're like, oh my God, this is so emotional. And that's the point of music. It's to bring people together, to bring in a flood of emotions. It's what we name the arts for, the humanities. It exposes our humanity. And sometimes not in a good way. Music is not benign in any stretch or form, but it can be. And I prefer to use it for good rather than some purposes to divide people.
Well, you guys put out a number of albums in the 70s, and it kind of culminated with a live album. And in some circles, they consider it one of the best live albums ever recorded. Part of it was recorded in London, and part of it was recorded in D.C., right?
That's right, yeah.
And whose idea was it for a live album at that time?
You know, I heard a couple of different things. Somebody said it was Lowell. I heard Warner Brothers threw out the idea, which either one of them makes sense to me, but particularly Warner Brothers, because they knew that we needed something to really help them help us. And we were noted for being a great live band. So if you connect the dots, Waiting for Columbus was a matter of playing some of our best music, or what we thought was our best music, under one roof, and then putting that out as a statement. So it made a lot of sense that Warner's, maybe in conjunction with Lowell or vice versa, had something to do with that.
Well, and Lowell, unfortunately, passed away soon thereafter, I guess, or somewhere in this time period. When exactly did he pass away?
I believe it was June 29th of 1977. And he was back in Washington, D.C. I don't remember where he was playing, but Fred Tackett was on that tour. And then that night, when he went to bed, he never woke up. So it was a very sad time.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously, the like you said, the band has had a lot of different, groups, iterations, and you feel like you're at the best where you are right now. But you took a break in the 80s, and then you reformed. And what was sort of the idea of getting back together and let's do this?
Oh, for Let It Roll, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, first I'm going to say that other people are saying we are the best of what we were. The way I view it personally is that when we were with Lowell, that was amazing stuff. Mm-hmm. It was amazing when we had Craig Fuller and later Sean Murphy. We have these pockets where there's, as you say, the iterations are all really astounding. The iteration where we are presently is musically better than it's been in a very, very long time. What happened was, for Let It Roll, we had about a 10-year hiatus. About 8 years or so into that, I was working with Bob Seger and getting ready to tour with him. But we had a jam session in a place called The Alley, which was in North Hollywood. And it was a room to commemorate Lowell, but it was also a room to commemorate Little Feet. This is our little hangout. And Bonnie Raitt used to rehearse there, so did Jackson Browne. So it was this clubhouse for us. And so we went in there and we tried it, not at that place. This was a secondary offer to go in there. But the first time, which was probably 6 months before that, or maybe even a year, we went and we tried to play, but we had too many guests there. And it just fell apart. So this time we said, if we ever do this again, it's just going to be us. And that's what it was. Well, we're in there. We're trying to play, I don't know, All That You Dream. What's the second chorus? Verse. Nobody could remember. I'd be like singing, Jingle Bells, Jingle All the Way. And then what? Now where's it go? You know, that kind of stuff. And when Paul and I were driving back to his place on the valley, I said, you know, this is a lot of fun doing this tonight. And I think what it pointed out to me and to both of us was how extraordinarily deep our music was and that we ought to reinvestigate it. I know it's a big hurdle to say, let's do it without Lowell, but I think we ought to give it a shot. But I got to do this 9-month tour with Seeger first. So that's kind of what we did. But in the interim, there was some writing going on. We wrote most of that stuff at my house in LA. And we brought in Craig Fuller, and there we go.
Do you think releasing Let It Roll sort of precipitated a renewed interest in your previous catalog?
No question about it.
Yeah, it did. I actually remember that. I remember when it was released, and I got a copy, and I saw you guys live soon thereafter, and so it's stuck in my head. You know, you put on a great show. It's one of the best shows I've ever seen.
Yeah, live. I think that's exactly where we are today. I said the same thing to Scott Gerard an hour ago. I said, we just have to keep in mind that when we do these things, we are in competition with ourselves. I'm not in competition with you, Scott, or with Tony Leone or Kenny Gradney or anybody else. We are in competition with our music and our albums. So from the first Little Feet record up until the last one, that's what we're in competition with. So whatever we're going to go on and record at some point, that's the high metric, is right there, the bar is right there. So, and we're doing that and more with taking on Waiting for Columbus, which is, as you said, some people think it's one of the best live albums ever made. It's kind of ballsy to go out there and try and say, yeah, well, this may be the first time you've heard us, and this is what we're doing. A lot of people have done that record. Fish, Don Was in a group that played it at the Sanger Auditorium. Jamie Johnson, I think, was in there. That band, a really great country singer. It's just what we're doing it now. And it's not an easy album to play. And everybody that's ever tried it, from Fish on up and down, and all of whom have done great job, by the way, but they all say the same thing. It's not as, and I go, difficult as, or it's more difficult than you thought? And they go, yeah. I go, absolutely. I mean, Oh Atlanta should sound like it's falling off a log, like it's just a walk through the park. And it is, until you try and play it. There's a lot there.
Well, and you guys, you were around pre-internet and then post-internet, and you had to go through that whole change of how you market yourself. And you were pretty innovative in the way that you took on the internet. Tell me a little bit about that.
I'm pretty good at adapting. That's what I'll say. And I do it selfishly because I want to continue to do what I love to do. I had people 15 years ago going, when are you going to retire? Oh, I don't know, 12 o'clock, 1 in the morning. Why? Well, this is, come on.
Well, and you know, obviously it has to do with creativity, and you really enjoy still writing music, right? And you enjoy performing?
Yeah. Well, you heard me play it earlier. Mm-hmm. So it's you can't do that unless you... You know, my advice to kids, and kids are not. I mean, 2 years younger than me. I always advise people with whatever you want to do, but if you're a musician, learn your instrument. You know, investigate that instrument. Have it be a part of your body and soul, and see where it can take you and where you can take it. There's your ticket to creativity and being inquisitive in life. It's not only playing an instrument. It's like, what food do you want to prepare? What are you reading? What are you aware of? That's what makes life interesting. And you're always going to get, you know, the pitchfork in the ass to either wake you up or to hurt you. That's part of life. But the other things that you can discover in this process of being creative, I think the rewards are that we talk ourselves out of far more things than we talk ourselves into. So if you can't speak Spanish, well, I can speak a little bit. I wish I could speak more. But es un buen lío, no sé más matido. It's a fine mess we've gotten ourselves into. Well, I got a few phrases I can toss off. ¿Me podría dar más agua, por favor? Bring me some water, but not tráigame. ¿Me podría dar? Which is a very polite way of saying it. So you're not only learning the phonetics and whatever to discover things, but you discover a culture. That culture is, this is the stuff that people fight wars over, like they're doing in Ukraine and Russia. There's all the economic reasons. But the heart of everything, somebody has aspirations in life. So the aspirations are for family, for getting along if we can. Those aspirations can also be for cordoning people off, not allowing them to vote, fear. Which side do you want to be on? It's a Stephen King novel on that level. So I think it makes life very, very interesting. And it can help keep one focused on what's important.
So from that perspective, what do you think the role of a musician is in some of the messaging or some of the important things going on in society at whatever period that is?
I think it varies. I think now, rather than there might be some people listening to this going, why don't you just shut up, you're a damn musician. And okay, fine. I'm also a citizen, right? So I have two black guys in our band, Sam Clayton and Kenny Gradney. You don't want them to vote? Why don't you tell them? You know, that kind of stuff. I think that I'm not going to get up on stage and in between songs start spouting off stuff. I want the music to hit people, to draw an emotion out of them that's positive. And it can be positive from tears to laughter, right? And then afterwards, if we get to meet some people and somebody comes up, hey, what's with this? You know, I'll talk with them or I'll go, hey, pick up a book sometime and read it. I mean, there's somebody when we did When All Boats Rise. It's a new song, right? And some guy goes, I don't have a boat. I go, all right, cool. I said, you know, I don't often write back to people, but in this case I did to this person. I said, look, whether you have a boat is irrelevant. It is an aspirational song, which means that, you know, like liberty, justice, and freedom for all. That's aspirational. Doesn't mean we have it. We would like to have it. Same thing with When All Boats Rise. It'd be better if we all had the same opportunities. We don't have the same acumen to deal with things. That's where, you know, you're not giving things away. You're giving people opportunities. That's a lot different. So I said, maybe start thinking aspirational. I never heard back from him, but I thought, you know, it wasn't a confrontation with the person. You know, we don't need that. We need people to start thinking what's the bottom line with what they want. You know?
When we have a conversation about the topics, so, you know, as opposed to telling people what they need to hear or telling them your opinion, just that dialogue of going back and forth and hearing what other people have to say and sharing those ideas goes a long way to elevating some of these you know, some of these really tough areas that we're dealing with right now in society, right, for sure.
Yeah, we've been dealing with them for a long, long time. I mean, slavery was on the mind of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. Washington said, we're not going to figure this out. We're going to kick that can down to somebody else. And they did. But he knew it wasn't right, but he still had slaves. So this is the way history works, is some things are never going to be sorted out, but a lot can be. And I think valuing people's voice is a good place to start. You know, why do they think a certain way? What is this something we're teaching our children, our grandchildren? If you were to project anything, where does it lead us in 100 years? That kind of thing. I don't have all the answers. I don't pretend to. But I can can tell you this. I've been in a group with two black cats for now 50 years plus. And we have different ways of coming to decisions on what we do. And it's not their color. It's just that we're individuals, what you were talking about earlier. How do people come to that decision-making process? It's brought up on a lot of things, the way we were raised, what we're open to accepting, what we reject out of hand, all the normal stuff. But if you're looking at the microcosm of being in a band, and there's your universe, that's a good way to look at things. It's through this compartment of people that you really know, and that we might not agree that the Celtics over the the Milwaukee Bucks is the, you know, which team do you like and why, that kind of thing. But it's always the same stuff, you know. I mean, a lot of it is subjective, but I think there's just certain things that are not subjective. They're what provides guidance to our core, to our hearts, to the way we think, you know. And I'd rather keep an open mind to things and say, hey, if I were in that person's shoes, how would I feel if somebody was pulling me over at every opportunity? If I'm in a Porsche with a white woman, and you get pulled over and have to explain yourself for the 100th time what you're doing, you know, hey, we might as well be in Russia.
Well, and each individual is made up of a variety of experiences that affect the lens that we look through life and how we make decisions and how we perceive things. And that is unique to each person. And so there's a lot of that that goes on, and, you know, trying to get in someone else's shoes, you never can be there entirely, but you can listen.
But I think, though, Amy, at the end of the day, that there are certain things when we talk about truth. If the score was 27-13, you can debate like how they got to that score, but you can't debate the score. That's what it was, right? So
right.
That's my thing. Just take a hard look at some of this stuff and go, okay, let's draw up these lines on either side where we don't allow people to vote. Just take it very simply, right? And so why do you want that? You want it because you want to have control over something in a life where we have control over very little. We could get outside and get hit with a comet or something. You know, we don't know. You walk across the street in London and look the wrong way, you could die instantly over there. That's why they have those signs on the street telling you to look right or look left. So a lot of it is fear-based. I don't like it. I mean, I'm a child of the 60s. I saw that stuff. I mean, I watched John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, all pass, Malcolm X. You know, we've always lived in turbulent times, but we're just in a place now. And again, musically, I think music helps. I think it helps a great deal. Calm things down a little bit. Let things, you know, it's like a wound that needs a little break. It doesn't mean that when people say Nazis have infiltrated Ukraine, and we know it's not true, that we go, oh yeah, that's just their way of thinking. You know what I mean? Well, yeah, it is their way of thinking, and they're wrong. And they're wrong because of this, this, and this, that, and that. It's the same thing over here. You know, you use your head to intellectualize what it is. And when people start to do that, then they go, well, God, maybe Huey Long wasn't right. You know, you don't have to name names, but we don't have to name names anymore. It's not about that. It's like, it's about, do you have a core to reach into and make an informed opinion on something that makes sense? What if it were your family? How would you feel? I think that's the best place to start. You know, you're afraid of a book? Well, let's discuss it with your kid. You know, you're afraid of this or that? Discuss it amongst each other. Don't yell at each other. Talk, like you said. That's the way things get. That's what we do when we write music. You think a band, read Keith Richards' biography on where Brian Jones get socked in the face, or Woody, you know. Keith throws him a right cross. I mean,
Keith.
People do not get along, let's just be honest. But in a band, you have to make the best go of it to get along. And that requires listening to the other person sometimes, oftentimes. And they need to listen to you as well.
Very well said. And we only have a couple of minutes here left. And I just wanted to find out from you what's next in 2022. Are you putting out a new album? Are you touring? What's going on?
We have a PBS special that's going to be released in June. We did it at the Ryman Auditorium, and that was a lot of fun. Charlie Starr from Blackberry Smoke, who we've written a couple songs together. I love this guy.
He's amazing.
He
love
is
Charlie.
We finally met because he was at the gig, but let me see. I actually have a list here. I got to look at this list because I can remember anybody. JoJo Herman was there from Widespread Panic. We played dual keyboards on a couple tunes. Eric Church joined us. Dixie Chick and Tommy Emmanuel, who's an amazing guitar player. He and I did a solo that's going to be on the extended version of something that we were just laughing.
Trying to figure out how he does some of those licks.
I don't know either, but we were looking at each other and we were playing, but when we listened to it, not together, but I said, when I heard our solo, Tommy, I was laughing. He said, I was too. And so it's one of those things. Jamie Johnson is incredible. Betty Levette, Jeff Hanna, Marcus King. We got a great array of people. And then our background singers were starting with John Cowan from the Doobies. He and I are just dear friends. I've been playing with the Doobies the last 7 years, and now I'm playing with Little Feet again. Amy Helm, Connor Kennedy, Rhonda's kid since he's probably 18 years old. I think he's approaching 28 or 29. I don't know. He's a great guy. And then Nikki Bloom. Those were our background vocalists. So we were in high cotton, I'll just put it that way. And so that's a great show. Next year, 2023, we are going to make an album. I'm not quite sure where, but there's a lot of material for it. So there's a really good energy and synergy taking place with Little Feet right now.
Well, when you put out the next album, come back and talk to us for a few minutes about that new album, and everyone needs to check out the performance of the Ryman. It sounds like an all-star cast of characters. So
it is. Charlie Martin has mixed it. We have a great team. Vector Management, which is Ken Levitan, Brian Penix, on and on. There's a great team with those people. We're all swimming the same direction, and it is something we haven't done in a very long time. And a lot of good things are happening because of that.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you, and enjoy your week in Montana. It's a little cooler there than it is where we are right now. But it was just really great getting to know you, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thanks, Amy. Enjoy Florida while you're down there.
Yeah.
in Memphis when you get home. And gosh, do I have to eat barbecue again? No.
Come see us in Memphis. We'll show you the studio.
We will. Memphis is a great town. All the bright lights in Memphis, the Commodore Hotel. Yeah, it's been a part of our language forever. Have a good one.
All right, that's a wrap for this edition of Insights. Be sure to visit BillPayneCreative.com or like his page on Facebook to keep up with what he's doing out there in the world. We can't thank Bill enough for stopping by to chat today, and all of you out there for tuning in. We aim to bring you the best in music-based conversations, and being able to connect with the legendary Bill Payne is right in line with our mission. So, from all of us at Diddy TV, thanks again for tuning in today, and we hope to see you again real soon, right here on Insights.